The genre of spy thriller tends to be dominated by macho action heroes who like their cars fast and their martinis shaken, not stirred. Think James Bond, of course, think Jason Bourne. Then switch gears completely and think Maddie James. She's the heroine of a new novel out this month titled Intelligence. And she's a somewhat unlikely heroine, an ex-ballerina with a bad back turned counterterrorism analyst. James lives with her mother and a pet rabbit named Abu Bunny. Well, Maddie James is the creation of writer and CIA insider Susan Hassler. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us a little bit more about your protagonist, Maddie James. And you describe her, I loved this, as the aptly named Maddie James. Not mad as in crazy, but mad as in really pissed off all the time. How come?
Well, she's mad because she feels like no one listened to her before the last terrorist attack, and because she feels like a lot of her time is being wasted. And that described a lot of us a few years after 9/11. And actually writing this novel was one way I had of dealing with all of the anger I had left over from that period.
Let me set the stage a little bit. The book follows Maddie and a team she's leading of CIA counterterrorism analysts. They are racing to thwart a new threat from Al-Qaeda. And this one involves not big planes, but little remote-controlled toy planes, hundreds of them.
Right. I wanted something that was plausible, but something I didn't think a terrorist could actually use. He wouldn't want to inspire anything. But I wanted to use planes because the idea was to create fear. And with everyone having the planes from the 9/11 attack in their mind, it had to be planes to raise that fear again.
One of the other characters in the book is this crusty old-timer named Doc, who is a mentor to Maddie. He's been there for forever, it seems like. And you use his voice often to speak about some of the tensions and the challenges that people working on counterterrorism face. There's a bit I'd love to have you read. It's on page 189.
Okay. Wolves in Warning: How to Negotiate the Thread That Stretches Between Crying Wolf and Failing to Warn. Warn too often and no one listens. Fail to warn and reap the bloody consequences.
It's a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't scenario. What's that like when you're actually working it?
Well, I can say that up until 9/11, we were being accused in various quarters of hyping the threat. And then after 9/11, we immediately became intelligence failures. If you do prevent an attack, nobody really knows about that. And you don't know yourself whether you actually saved any lives. All you know is that, you arrested this person and he was planning an attack and it might have happened. But if you fail, you know exactly how many people died.
One thing I found really interesting about this book is you have Maddie and all the other characters spend most of the novel sitting in this stale, stuffy CIA conference room, sitting around bickering. I mean, it's very different from a lot of novels in this genre where they leap from one high-speed car chase to the next and you have the hero jetting from Beirut to Moscow and off to Paris. Wait, was that a deliberate choice in how you wanted to tell this story, I wonder?
I did want to reflect a more realistic side. I was in the agency 21 years and never met a Bond woman, but I met a lot of women I considered more interesting than that and a lot of men. It is sitting around a room, but that's what we do. And I wanted to, it was a challenge, but I wanted to see if you could actually write a thriller under those restraints.
The CIA that you describe in this novel is a bureaucratic nightmare in many ways. I mean, it's more effective at sabotaging its own work than the terrorists could ever be. There's a great moment where Maddie James has a light bulb burned out over her desk, and she has tried a million times to get maintenance to come fix it, and they won't, so she finally brings in a light bulb from home and climbs up and fixes it herself. Are things really that bad, or are you taking a little bit of literary license there?
Oh, both. There are days when you just wanted to throw the computer out the window. Things crash. Software upgrades were the bane of our existence. Nothing starts working right away, and you need things to start working right away.
It sounds like the characters in your book are so haunted by 9/11, which I'm sure is the way counterterrorist analysts working at Langley headquarters really felt in the days after 9/11. There's one passage that really gets it. That's a character reflecting on the difference between what he's doing as a counterterrorism analyst versus what someone like you can do writing about these things as a work of fiction. I wonder if you would read us, there's a few lines on page 46.
In our world, there's an AK-47 above the mantel, a basket full of grenades on the table, a half kilo of plastic explosive under the couch cushion, ricin in the candy dishes, and sarin in the air vents. And none of it is significant because in the end, it's the pistol hidden in the drawer that kills you. What I was trying to get at here is that Chekhov is known for his quote that in fiction, if you put a pistol above the mantle, it has to go off by the end of the play. And that was a problem. When I was writing this, as a novelist, you have to put enough clues in it so that your reader is not completely at sea. And it gives the false impression that this job is easier than it really is.
That there is a string of clues being presented to you and dropped in front of you one by one that you should be able to follow. In real life, it's not so easy, I guess.
In real life, it's like somebody's pouring boxes of puzzle pieces from a jigsaw puzzle, and they're pouring continuously, and you don't have the picture to go by, and one piece might belong to this puzzle, it might belong to another puzzle. There are many things that are irrelevant to the attack that's coming up, but you don't know that they're irrelevant, so you waste time, you know, going down rabbit holes.
That's Susan Hassler, a 21-year veteran of the CIA, talking about her new novel, Intelligence. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now for a Cold War secret that's been revealed in Britain. Back in the 1960s, the British government devised a plan to protect Queen Elizabeth in the event of nuclear attack. The plan was called the Python System. It called for the Queen and her husband, Prince Philip, to quickly go on board the royal yacht Britannia. The vessel would become a floating bunker hidden in the sea inlets along a remote coast of Scotland. As the historian who obtained the once secret plan put it, the Queen was, quote, going to lurk in the sea locks.
We continue our summer book series, Thrilled to Death. It's our new summer series where we talk with thriller writers about the writing process and what works inspire them. Ever since Holmes and Watson, the thriller genre has been the home of buddies, friends from different walks of life who join forces to solve crimes. Author Tess Gerritsen is the latest writer to try this approach. She's a physician as well as being a thriller author, and her new book is called Ice Cold. And tonight, a television show based on one of her previous works, Rizzoli and Isles, is debuting on the network TNT. Tess Gerritsen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Can you do us a favor? Could you give us a quick description of Rizzoli and Isles and why these two women are quintessential Gerritsen characters?
Jane Rizzoli is the outsider. She's a classic outsider. She's the woman who was raised with two brothers and always had to defend herself. So now she's in a blue-collar, kind of a tough neighborhood, and she also has to be a homicide detective in a unit that has all men. And because of that, she is somebody who has a little bit of a chip on her shoulder, and she tries to be better than the men. Maura Isles, I have to admit, is very much like me. She believes in science. She's a medical examiner, a medical doctor. She wants to look at the logic behind why things happen.
When you're writing a buddy thriller, is there something that allows you to, I guess, write about both sides of your own character, if you can sort of explore people through different portals if you've got this buddy?
Yes, absolutely. That's a good question. What I most identified with in Jane was that outsider thing. I'm Asian American, and I was the only Chinese girl growing up in a white school in San Diego. So I understood what it was like to be different, to always want to fit in and never feel like you ever could. And whenever I would write Jane's scenes, that was what I was feeling.
Thriller writers deal with material that is deep and scary and takes the reader to some very dark spaces. How much do you allow the reader to enter your life? Because you write about yourself, and in some ways you also write about other things that have happened to you. You've talked about the childhood difficulties that you experience with your own mother, how that has informed some of your fiction. How much do you let people in?
I try to make them think it's all fiction. I don't want them to know how much of myself is in those stories. When I think about why they are so dark, I mean, I can give you two reasons why. One of them is that my mother is an immigrant from China, and she loved horror films. So I spent my childhood watching every scary movie that Hollywood ever made. And I think that gave me the best education for storytelling. It also made me want to reproduce the scary moments that I felt sitting in a theater at the age of 5. The other thing that came from my childhood, and I think it drives a lot of my fiction, there was a beloved family friend. I considered him an uncle. He was always good to me, and I really adored him. And then he went to prison for murdering a woman. It makes me realize that there is a lot that's hidden behind a smiling face. And I think fiction for me is a way of trying to understand why people do the things they do and trying to explain what is at heart illogical.
Tell me about the works that inspired you. You talked about the films you used to watch. What about the books? Are there thriller writers that you turn to when you need inspiration?
Well, you know, sometimes I think about what is it about a thriller that grabs my attention, and I notice a lot of them have to do with women. One I was thinking about recently was Ken Follett's Eye of the Needle. I was not really reading that many thrillers when I picked up that book, and it was the first time I saw a male writer so well describe in very great detail the inner workings of a woman, and that woman ended up being the heroine of that particular story.
Now, you talked about the influence that your mother had on you, sitting there watching all those horror movies with her.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what your profession, your chosen profession, that impact that might have on your two boys. Have you thought about that?
I think I gross my sons out quite a bit. There's a story that we remember. It was around Halloween, and they were responsible for coming up with a scary room in the local haunted house. And I said, oh, I have a great idea. We're going to go to the butcher shop. We're going to get entrails, pig entrails, and we're going to lay out a person as if he's on the operating table and pile the entrails on top of him. Won't that be scary? And they said, Mom, you are just too gross. You can't even think about that.
So did you do it?
No, they didn't. I can't remember what happened, but I still remember how they looked at me with utter horror. And these were teenage boys. So, when you can gross out your own teenage boys, I think that's that says something about your family.
Tess Gerritsen, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's Tess Gerritsen. She joined us for our series, Thrilled to Death. Her latest book is called Ice Cold.
Sloane Crosley is a book publicist who hit pay dirt with her own writing, a best-selling collection of New York-centric humorous essays called I Was Told There'd Be Cake. For her second collection, just out, How Did You Get This Number?, she ventures from Manhattan to Portugal and beyond.
I had always, when I was younger, wanted to spin a globe and point to somewhere and go to the place to which I pointed. And that is exactly what happened. Actually, that's not exactly what happened. The first time I did it, I pointed to the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And I thought, well, no one's here to see me cheat. I don't need to be on a raft right now. So I did it again, and that's when I hit Lisbon.
You are a New York City woman, and there's an essay in the book, when you were your best friend's bridal party in Alaska.
Here are the types of Alaskan residents, not including native tribes. 1. Military personnel. 2. State builders. 3. Nature enthusiasts. By which I mean raw, in-your-face nature. Birdwatching is for house cats. 4. Hippie nutballs who looked at Portland, Oregon and thought, this is way too urban, I have to get out of here. 5. People who have at one point done something very illegal involving a sawed-off shotgun and freezer bags.
This is, to just put it in a category, kind of a fish-out-of-water essay, the city slicker goes to the country kind of thing.
Right.
When you were writing it for the collection, was it a challenge to keep it from becoming a cliche?
Yes. The challenge is, in the effort to avoid cliché, you might go too far. I think in the effort to avoid cliché, sometimes you think, well, the easiest way to do that is to add an additional spark, an additional story, something that's totally unique. And what you risk in doing that is doing this sort of dancing monkey routine and having a joke per minute, per hour, per sentence. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, while you're not looking, it turns out that your essay has lost its meaning. Huh. And it's lost its sort of universal application. So it's sort of a tightrope to walk.
Paris. Now, this was when you were 19, right?
Yeah, the first time I went there, I was 19.
Okay. Tell us what happened at Notre Dame.
I had gone to Paris, and I had gone with a friend, and we decided to do a day of visiting cathedrals, and there were some museums in there as well, I believe. But the highlight for her especially was Notre Dame. And we went, and I was waiting in line with her for confession, and I had always thought that confession was like the movies. I didn't have a lot of direct experience with it because I'm Jewish. And I thought that, you know, you go and you go into a sort of small little velvet phone booth and you give up everything you have and you're hopefully absolved. And then that's that. Where do I start? Emily was giddy with intimidation. I hadn't thought of this. If you are 19 years old and have never confessed, do you begin with the cigarette inhaled before noon this morning, or the time you stole a package of sparkly pipe cleaners from your second grade art class and kept them in the bottom of your closet for 2 years, eventually throwing them out because you felt so guilty? Do you mention the lying, the drinking, the cheating, the gambling, the masturbation, the schadenfreude, the disrespecting of your parents, the disrespecting of other people's parents, the doing of the drugs, the shoplifting of the gum, the coveting of worldly goods, the advantage taking, the responsibility foisting, the tone you use with food delivery people when you're alone and they're foreign, that time you had a hangnail on your toe, so you stuck your foot in your mouth and you bit it off like a monkey? Or is that all kind of a given by now?
At Notre Dame.
And at Notre Dame, really. I just chose the most, you know, Olympic grandest stage I could find.
Why do you think the essay form suits you? I ask this because the last piece in the book is almost novella-sized, and are you beginning to write longer pieces?
It's huge, that last piece. I didn't think I actually had anything to say. And then out popped this, you know, 13,000-word baby. I have always wanted to write fiction, and I do think that the essay format suits me for now because a little bit of your work is done for you. That's the dirty secret with nonfiction. You have sort of 15% of the world to work off, and then you do the rest. You don't have to create everything from whole cloth. And I think, you know, life in New York especially is so frenetic that the idea that you can stop, that you can write an essay and move on to a different thought and take that thought to its completion without actually having to constantly check back in with it is kind of a relief. And it's easier to be funny, I think, in a shorter format.
Sloane Crosley's collection of essays is called How Did You Get This Number? And the author joined us from our New York studio. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Author Sue Miller has written a story collection, a memoir about her father and Alzheimer's disease, as well as 9 novels. Her latest novel is titled The Lakeshore Limited. For our series, You Must Read This, where authors talk about a book they love, Miller recommends a novel with a varied cast of characters, all of whom jump right off the page.
When Thomas McMahon, a professor of both applied mechanics and biology at Harvard University, died unexpectedly a little more than a decade ago, his legacy was voluminous. It included multiple scientific articles, the design for the track at Harvard, a handful of patents, including one licensed to Nike for a new kind of sole for a running shoe, and 4 entirely distinctive novels. My favorite among them is McKay's Bees. It's the kind of book which makes you want to sequester yourself away from the dinner table or the cocktail party when you encounter the rare other person who's read it, so you can compare notes on its many delights. Among them, its frequent hilarity, its occasional tender sexiness, and the sheer erudition on display within its pages. Do you want Darwin's theory explained in a few words? Why, it's about the greenness of every living thing, its sexual purpose, and its mortal nature. Do you want to know how to divide and multiply beehives? You'll find it here. how to build a small funicular to get you upstairs without electricity, how to make a daguerreotype, construct a kiln, all included for the price of admission, and all connected intimately to the foibles, the hopes, the aims, the character of the characters in this book. And what an assortment of characters they are. First, we meet the eponymous Gordon McKay, fat, industrious, wealthy, distractible, who sets out from Boston in 1855 with his new wife, 15 swarms of bees, and an entourage that includes a group of German music box makers and two alligators. They're headed for Kansas, where McKay hopes to make a fortune from honey. His wife, Catherine, is vain and passionate. She's married McKay in part to extract herself from her erotically charged relationship with her twin brother, Colin. Then there's the melancholic bee expert L.L. Langstroth, whose manual sets McKay in motion, the abolitionist Eli Thayer and his wife, and the naturalist William Sewell. John Brown makes an appearance here, too, and Louis Agassiz, and Presidents Lincoln and Pierce, all quickly made complex and human. To read this book is to be present at a strange moment in our nation's history, on the cusp of the Civil War, of the Second Industrial Revolution, which is where McKay finally does make his fortune. McMahon makes their preoccupations, their sorrows and joys so arresting that you can read this book 2, 3, 4 times, as I have, before you take in also the grand sweep of it. Of course, there's a narrative distance necessary to accomplish all this in so few pages, but it's not an ironic distance or a satiric one, though there's often humor in it. Instead, McMahon's tone here seems almost Chekhovian to me. It has that same gentle, rueful amusement. Witty, precise, tender, McMahon beckons us, as Chekhov does, to an enlarging generosity and wonder at all that is sad and funny and amazing in the world. You must read it.
Sue Miller is the author of many novels, including her latest, The Lakeshore Limited. She recommends the novel McKay's Bees by Thomas McMahon for our series, You Must Read This.
In this day and age, it's hard to imagine a time when a simple scrape could turn deadly. The flu killed thousands, and pneumonia wasn't just fatal for the elderly. Lauren Belfer brings us back to this time in her new book, A Fierce Radiance. This historical novel, which is also part mystery and part romance, is set in the early years of World War II, when the medical community and the military were in a race against time to develop penicillin. Belfer also draws us into the greed and intrigue that surrounded the development of a new breed of drugs that would not only save millions of lives, but would also be worth millions of dollars. Lauren Belfer joins us now to discuss her book. Thanks so much for being with us, Lauren.
Great to be here, Lynn.
Now, I understand that you had a really personal reason for looking into this history of penicillin. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, for me, A Fierce Radiance is a family story. For all the years that I knew her, my elderly aunt kept on her bureau a photograph of her brother when he was about 10 years old, sitting in a canoe with his father, you know, having a wonderful time on a summer vacation. He was dead a year later. He died on the 4th of July in the 1920s of a fast-moving infection, and there was nothing his doctors could do to save him.
You know, I have to say, I really had not thought much about the kinds of simple things that could turn deadly before the development of penicillin and the other antibiotics, as you describe in this book. How much did you know about it, other than your own personal experience and the stories you heard, before you really started your research on this?
Well, I knew nothing about it. And I should go back a little bit. Many people, when they think of penicillin, think, oh, Alexander Fleming, 1928. But the fact is that Alexander Fleming couldn't do anything with the penicillin that he discovered. The technology didn't exist. Penicillin was virtually forgotten until the beginning of the Second World War, when scientists were trying to find substances that could help battlefield wounds. And what they found was that the mold, the penicillium mold, grew best in a flat surface, and they just didn't have the technology to create huge flat surfaces, so they used what was at hand. They had milk bottles, they had bedpans, that's what they used. And the great challenge of the war was to find a way to mass produce penicillin, because clearly if you're just harvesting it drop by drop from a milk bottle, you're not going to be able to supply, say, the entire United States military with penicillin. But by D-Day, 1944, that's exactly what American industry had done.
Now, at the same time, the penicillin was the military's focus, but as your book makes clear, and again, it's fiction, but according to your book, at the same time, there were what you call penicillin's cousins being developed. And this is what the pharmaceutical companies were really interested in, because that's where the profit was. Why is that?
Well, because penicillin was considered, quote-unquote, a weapon of war. That's what they called it. The United States government took over the production, and penicillin was made under the supervision of the same group that was supervising the Manhattan Project for the atomic bomb. And because the government controlled the production, the government took the patents. But there were patents to be made available for the other antibiotics. This became what is now a billion-dollar industry. It did not exist in 1940.
Now, Claire Shipley, who is the heroine of this novel, is a photographer for Life magazine, and this really sort of was very evocative of a certain time in this country's history when a magazine like Life had so much influence on the culture.
Yes, Life began in 1936 and was an overnight sensation. When I began research for the novel, I read every issue of Life magazine from 1939, when the war began in Europe, to 1945. And I made some astonishing discoveries doing that. What I tried to do when I wrote the book was to put myself in the shoes of people living those years out. So as I read Life magazine, I realized that Americans expected that their cities would be bombed. Life magazine gave people advice on what to do in bombing raids. I remember an article about what to do with your pets during bombing raids, because pets weren't allowed in the shelters. I mean, I thought I knew a lot about World War II, but these kinds of things, I mean, that really brought the war home to me.
Lauren Belfer, her new novel is A Fierce Radiance. Lauren, thanks so much. It was good talking with you.
Thank you, Lynn. Wonderful to talk to you.